This free programming is paid for by the listener sponsors of KPFK. During our fund drive, you can pledge online by clicking the links on the front of kpfk.org. Thank you for supporting Free Speech Radio.
24th, thanks for joining us. Thanks to Rose Katapshi, who produced the recorded portions of this broadcast. She's also behind the controls tonight. With Glenn Reeder, I'm John Hamilton. Good evening.
You've been listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and we stream globally on kpfk.org. Now stay tuned for Feminist Magazine, that's coming right up. Don't touch that dial.
Hi, this is Roseanne Barr. Have you heard the news? The local KPFK station board elections have begun. Nominations for local station board members is ongoing now, and any current member of KPFK is eligible to run. If you are not a current member, a minimum donation of $25 today qualifies you to be a valid member of KPFK. This year's board elections are crucial because 60% of the station board seats are open for election. Any new station board members could possibly affect the future of KPFK. So, for more information or to request an elections packet by mail, please call the Pacifica Board Elections Hotline at 1-866-PEACE-01. That's 1-866-732-2301. Or go to www.pacificafoundation.org/elections/.
Nomination period for the election ends Wednesday, July 15th.
Magazine is on the air. Each week we bring you programming with wisdom and wit by women of all ages. I'm Melissa Chiprin. I'm here with my co-host,
Christine Kings.
It is estimated that nearly 7,000 rape kits sit on LAPD freezer shelves waiting testing, with at least 217 of them past the statute of limitations, rendering them useless even if a rapist is identified by the DNA collected. How can these expired kits be resuscitated, if at all? And is this even an option? Lindsay Horvath, president of Hollywood Now and recently appointed to the West Hollywood City Council, will explore thus how this could have happened and the work culminating in a system that will eradicate the backlog of untested rape kits and hold the LAPD accountable for the expenditure of funds allocated.
We will also be hearing a critical interview aired in August of 2007 with Rufina Juarez, one of the leaders of the South Central Farmers of Los Angeles and representative of La Red Chicana Indígena. We discussed the sixth session of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues at the UN. The primary role was to denounce the injustice and suffering that was imposed on the South Central Farm families, women, and children as geographically displaced Indigenous peoples by the City of Los Angeles and the same LAPD that rioted on the poor people of Los Angeles on May 1, 2007. As well, Ms. Juarez's report from the Continental Network of Indigenous Women, a space for Indigenous women that allows for an exchange of experiences and seek alternatives which challenge the Indigenous movement and their own government's programs, all of which are issues currently as pertinent as they were in 2007, actually even more so. But first, Jessica Valenti, founder and executive editor of Feministing.com, and author of Full Frontal Feminism, A Young Woman's Guide to Why Feminism Matters, and He's a Stud, She's a Slut, and 49 Other Double Standards. She'll be discussing her latest book, The Purity Myth, How America's Obsession with Virginity is Hurting Young Women. Ms. Valenti examines the fallacies of virginity, chastity, and purity in a thoroughly modern context through the lens of our sexually charged media culture. Stay tuned.
Tonight I'm speaking with Jessica Valenti, self-described feminist writer and blogger, founder and editor of Feministing.com, and the author of Full Frontal Feminism, A Young Girl's Guide to Why Feminism Matters. He's a Stud, She's a Slut, and 49 Other Double Standards Every Woman Should Know. Ms. Valenti is also a co-editor of the anthology Yes Means Yes, Visions of Female Sexual Power, and A World Without Rape. Valenti's writing has appeared in The Nation, The Guardian UK, The American Prospect, Ms. Magazine, Salon.com. She received her master's in women's and gender studies from Rutgers University, where she is now a part-time lecturer. Jessica speaks at universities and organizations across the country on feminism, blogging, and politics. Tonight, Jessica joins us to discuss her new book, The Purity Myth, How America's Obsession with Virginity is Hurting Young Women, published by Silk Press. Welcome, Jessica.
Welcome, Jessica.
Thanks. Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So let's get right into this. As you state in your book, what virginity is, what it was, and how it's being used to punish women and roll back their rights is at the core of the purity myth. You go on to write, where porn culture and re-energized abstinence movements collide, the moral panic myth about young women's supposed promiscuity is diverting attention away from the real problem. So let's break this down. First, what is the purity myth and what is the moral panic myth about young women's supposed promiscuity?
Sure. The purity myth is the lie that women's sexuality has, some bearing on who they are and how good they are as people. You know, I think that we should be teaching our daughters that their ability to be good people is dependent on things like their intelligence, their compassion, their wit and their sense of humor, not whether or not they have sex. And that's what they're being taught right now. And the moral panic kind of relates to that. I think that we're all pretty used to seeing all of the headlines about girls gone wild and college girls on spring break and girls are having sex and isn't it terrible? And really this is just, you know, a way to distract us from the issues that are really affecting young women.
And what are those issues that what you say this is the real problem, this is diverting. So what is the issues that we should be focusing on?
I mean, sadly, a lot of them are the same issues that we were focusing on 30 years ago. Things like violence, things like, access to birth control and reproductive rights, things like health care, issues especially right now, of income. So, there's all of these kind of hard issues that are out there that young women are facing that take a lot more than a moral scolding to fix. And yet what's easier to talk about, and certainly what's more salacious to talk about, is young girls having sex.
And the backlash, talk about how it's a backlash, because it always seems as women, you gain any, gain anything, then there's the backlash.
I feel like the backlash makes it sound like it happens so quick, but it's ongoing forever, No, the backlash never ends. I think that there is a backlash, and I think under the Bush administration there was an 8-year-long backlash against women's rights and against all the gains that we made, and that's why we saw so many rollbacks across the board, whether it was pay equity, at the Office of Violence Against Women, or on abortion rights, we saw rollbacks across the board. And now that we're under a new administration, which I'm really thankful for, we can make some progress, but we also have to undo a lot of the damage that's been done as well.
And there is no, as you state, working medical definition for virginity.
No.
I found that really interesting.
I found it really interesting as well. I mean, who knew? It literally, there's no definition. There's no medical definition. There's no diagnostic standard for virginity. It's something that's completely socially constructed. And of course, we all kind of have an idea of what, losing one's virginity is supposed to mean. But that's just a social definition. That's not a real medical definition. So I just found it really interesting that people were putting so much stock in something that we really have no idea what it is.
Right, and virgin means usually a white blonde
exactly.
girl.
I call them the perfect virgins. I call them in the book,
who are
white and thin and blonde and straight. They represent this perfect virgin that we're all supposed to aspire to. And of course, most women don't fit into that.
And we'll talk later about that intersection of racism and sexism.
Sure.
But I'd like just to first give more of an understanding for our audience. A complete analysis really can't not be had if we don't recognize and look at the way virginity is deeply embedded in patriarchy, capitalism, and male ownership. Talk about this.
Oh, it's all over the place. I mean, I think probably the best example where you can where you can see that, though it is all around us. I think in its most explicit form, you can see it in purity balls, which are happening across the country. They're happening in almost every state. And these are essentially daddy-daughter dances. We're in the middle of the dance. The daughter will pledge her virginity to her father, and the father will pledge to protect his daughter's virginity and watch over it until the day, you know, she gets married and a husband comes to take his place. And the language is very much mired in ownership. And it's very, very disturbing. And the balls are federally funded.
I was just looking at Melissa and thinking, it sounds weird.
Well, and the way you write it in the book, that one of the descriptions, it was kind of creepy, almost like a date. It's kind of like borderline weird incestual.
Well, you know, they call it a date. They frame it as a date. And
right.
Focus on the Family had a similar thing where they had a campaign called Date Your Daughters. And the whole idea is you should take your daughters out, fathers should take their daughters out on dates so they should, in order to understand how men should treat them, which, it just doesn't sit right with me. You know, I'm all for good father-daughter relationships, but I think there's a way to nurture that without, you know, relying on rhetoric of dating and romance and sexuality.
Yeah, because in the description in the book, the young girl's like, oh, I got excited and we were sharing. You wouldn't know this was her father she was talking about.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And even in the purity balls, you know, the girls get dressed up as, and it looks like they're going to the prom. And in a lot of the pictures, they look like, you know, little wives next to their fathers. And it's very disconcerting. And if you have a chance, you know, they're all over YouTube and you can watch them. I highly recommend watching them for yourselves, just so people realize that I'm not exaggerating.
And how virginity is a commodity. I mean, capitalism has a lot to do with this whole, in my thing, of everything you've written about.
Of course. Of course. I mean, you know, of course, explicitly back in the day, virginity was very much a commodity in terms of marriage being a business and daughters being bought and sold. And I think now you could argue the same thing in terms of pop culture and what we consume. And, you know, all the Disney princesses and the, you know, the Miley Cyruses and the Britney Spears and this concern over their virginity and the way their quote unquote purity is marketed to young people and the way that we're supposed to buy it is really interesting. But, you know, some of those really explicit things are still happening as well in classes. In some abstinence-only education classes, they give out virginity vouchers, which are literally like credit cards.
Right, you compared it to MasterCard and Visa.
Yeah. Like, really? You need a credit card to prove you're a virgin? It was very telling.
Yeah, actually, I was just going to bring that one up because it was really creepy, one of the tenets of this. And you tell us about the gold rose pin.
Oh, the gold rose pin. It's one of my favorite stories. In some abstinence-only education classes, the girls in the class, and only the girls, are given a small gold rose pin, and attached to the pin is a card. And the card reads, "You are like a beautiful rose. Every time you engage in premarital sex, a precious petal is stripped away. Don't leave your future husband holding a bare stem. Abstain." The idea being that, you know, if you have sex, you are a bare stem, you're worthless, you're ugly, you will have nothing to offer a future mate. You know, I'm all for being honest with young people, and I'm all for promoting abstinence in schools as well as promoting contraception, but I think there's a way to do that without shaming young people and making them feel like they're going to be worthless, you know, pieces of
And
garbage.
Then it's reinforced then by males from the from what they're taught. And you are,
right.
I mean, I remember once as babysitting a six-year-old girl, and her friend, a boy came over, a friend of hers, and, you know, I was, you know, in charge of all this, and all of a sudden the boy said, "Is that your mom?" And the other boy said about her, a six-year-old girl, "No, she's too hoochie to have a mom." Yeah, and it scared me, you know, but I mean, that's this whole, I don't know where that, you know, these ideas come from, and she didn't understand, and I had to explain to her, you know, but this idea of dirty girls and clean girls is really...
That language starts very early, I think. I think I write about this in the book. You know, the first time I heard the word slut was in, you know, the fourth or fifth grade, and some girl said, you know, "I heard you called me a slut." And I was like, I don't even know what that is. You know, I think that it is starting younger and younger.
It is, and it was funny because I was turned on pop music just to get... And I was just, after reading your book, and I heard this song... It was about, and there's lots of these kind of songs. It was a song, "I'm the Guy Who's Going to Make the Good Girls Go Bad."
Oh.
That whole concept, which reinforces this again. And she, in the song, is innocent and she's shy.
Right.
And then he's going to make her go bad, but then but then she's going to be his woman. I mean, it's like just so bizarre,
right.
this
Yeah, that narrative plays itself out a lot, though, in pop culture and in porn culture. I mean, if you look at Girls Gone Wild, one of the main, you know, tropes behind Girls Gone Wild is this idea that you're taking young, you know, 17-year-old girls about to turn 18, about to go wild, young, nice girls, and making them dirty and bad. So, yeah, I think that shows up again and again.
Yeah, actually, your piece on Girls Gone Wild is very, really disturbing because basically it's rape. And can you describe for our audience about a little about that?
Yeah, you know, it was not something I expected to turn up. Well, I mean, I guess I did, but not in this kind of systematic way. You know, Girls Gone Wild, the company that runs around is comprised of Joe Francis, who's the most popular, you know, who's the most well-known. He's the head of the company. And but all of his other cohorts and his colleagues go, you know, to college campuses, and they bring this party bus, and they get girls on the bus and get them drunk and take them doing sexual things. But the thing is that a good number of them have been charged with sexual assault multiple times. Joe Francis certainly has been charged with sexual assault multiple times. And there was this article that talked about how someone watching the way that these men operated around, you know, drunk teenage girls, you know, separating one girl from her friends, telling her to get on the party bus.
And then waiting for, they watch them and wait for them to get really drunk, and then like phone calls are made, okay, we've got a drunk one here, basically.
Exactly. And then they usher her onto the bus, and actually the party bus, the quote-unquote party bus, is the place that most of the alleged sexual assaults have taken place. So it just seems very predatory to me. It's like this is like a roaming band of rapists.
And it's a huge money amount, making a huge amount of money. And,
yeah, absolutely.
And what kind of message is it saying? So, but then how that collides with the purity myth, it kind of works together.
It all does work together. You know, it was really amazing how many things kind of came under this framework as I was writing the book, you know, whether it was, you know, abortion rights or the obvious things like purity balls or violence against women and things like Girls Gone Wild.
Hey, you mentioned in your book, like, there's a few really tragic cases, but about getting emergency contraception or a rape kit, and you couldn't get it. And even one woman who was raped, they didn't believe her.
Yeah.
Talk about a little about getting, because I thought we were past that part. I didn't know this was.
Yeah, sadly, no. I mean, this is one of, I hate to call it one of the good things about the blogosphere, but it is good that this is coming to light. You know, individual women's stories are being heard because they are writing blogs and because these stories are getting around. You know what I mean? You no longer need to depend on the mainstream media. So there was one blogger who, you know, wrote about her experience trying to get emergency contraception and being denied everywhere she went. And then finally, you know, she finally got it, but at that point it was too late. She ended up becoming pregnant and she needed to get an abortion. And it was like, you know, this terrible, horrible story of this woman trying to get a legal contraceptive so that she wouldn't have to have an abortion and just the hurdles that were put in front of her.
And then in one case, there was a woman who actually was raped, but they didn't believe her.
Yes, this I believe the woman you're talking about is a woman in D.C. She was a college student who was drugged and raped.
Yeah.
And when she showed up to the hospital, they refused to give her a rape kit because they said she appeared inebriated. Now, of course, if someone has been drugged, it makes sense that they would appear inebriated.
Right.
And even if she was drunk and not drugged, that doesn't mean a rape didn't take place. They refused to give her a rape kit, and I believe that she's suing. But just the fact that this is still going on is reprehensible.
And then, you know, let's get back to this federally funded abstinence program, where, like, in a 2004 report from Representative Henry Waxman showed that more than 80% of federally funded abstinence programs contain false or misleading information about sex and reproductive health.
Yeah.
So talk more about this.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just false, you know, like just making up statistics, but it's also dangerous. You know, one class in Montana taught kids that condoms cause cancer. And it shows, study after study shows that kids who have gone through abstinence-only education are just as likely to have sex, but less likely to use contraception because it doesn't work. So we're literally messing with young people's lives here. We're lying to them and putting them in danger. I actually just wrote a piece for The Nation, I believe that's out now, called The Virginity Movement Rebranded, about how the abstinence movement now under the Obama administration is trying to kind of rebrand their message because they recognize that so many people know what they're up to now. They know that their programs aren't working, so they have to kind of get themselves together and figure out a way to reach people again.
And then this links to the 2000 Abstinence Awareness Week, which is federally funded. How could these things be federally funded?
Well, you know, under the 2010 budget, most of that funding will go away, thankfully. President Obama did away with most of the abstinence only education funding and replaced it with teen pregnancy prevention funding. But about 25% of it, and I think that's about $166 million, will still be available to new programs and possibly to programs that are abstinence only. So we do have to kind of keep our eye on the ball. We can't rest on our laurels.
Never.
You know, we have a new administration now.
Absolutely. And a very important aspect of this is the intersection between sexism and racism. Can you tell our audience how this has played out?
This is nothing that hasn't been said before by people like bell hooks. But it's true. You know, we the women we venerate in the U.S. for their sexuality, the perfect virgins, are overwhelmingly white. The way that we look at women of color sexuality is markedly different. We do not venerate them for their virginity because women of color are never seen as pure. They're seen as dirty and sexualized to begin with. You know, you can't dirty something that's already sullied. And the really, truly dangerous way that ends up playing out in real women's lives is that under the purity myth, it's more acceptable to do violence to women of color, to immigrant women, to poor women, to women who don't fit under this perfect virgin model, right? Because, you know, you're not selling them, they can't fall off the pedestal. So it somewhat explains, I think, the disproportionate amount of sexual violence aimed at certain groups of women.
Yeah, and you talk about how, like, there'll be the next to a picture of the perfect, you know, for the purity ball ad, the perfect white virgin, which doesn't even exist this whole, but the blonde, blue-eyed virgin girl. And then next to it will be of high poverty rates and STDs,
yeah.
you know, kind of intentionally trying to suggest or blatantly to say, you know, who's the pure, clean, and who has poverty and sexual diseases, which there's no truth to all this.
Right. Well, I mean, like, it's who is this moral panic directed at? Who are we worried about? Right. We're not worried about young women of color not having health insurance or the high rate of STIs in some communities. We're worried about college girls on spring break and whether or not they're showing their boobs. I think that really says something about who America cares about.
And before, you know, there's so much more to talk about, and so I really recommend for our audience to check out this book, The Purity Myth. But before I want to give us a little hope here, and your last chapter is the post-virgin world. Can you give us some of the actions people can take that you talk?
There are so many different actions. Yeah, I mean, I just really, you know, I think when you talk about something as insidious and as deeply ingrained as the sexual double standard and things like purity and virginity, it seems overwhelming. It seems like there's nothing you can really do to change things like that. But I think that there are things that you can do to change your community. You know, you can look to see what your kids are learning at school, see if they have abstinence-only education or not, or if they have, you know, great comprehensive sex education. You can look at what your kids are watching on TV and teach them to be media savvy. You know, teach them that the images that they see of women on television are not realistic, and use that as a place to open up conversations. And really, I think the most important thing that we can do for young women especially is teach them to be critical thinkers and hold up role models from our everyday lives. I think that we all know amazing women in our everyday lives that are probably better role models than young women are getting through mainstream media and pop culture.
Well, in closing, thank you so much, Jessica Valentin. I just want to let our listeners know, in this book, at the end of the book, there's lots of ideas, actually critical questions to help talk to your youth about, you know, everything that Jessica and I have been talking about today. It's a really resourceful book. And then you list a lot of websites and all kinds of solutions and things to do, literal things to do.
Yes, I'm all about the solutions.
Yes. So I've been speaking with Jessica Valente about her latest book, The Purity Myth, How America's Obsession with Virginity is Hurting Young Women, published by Sail Press. Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you so much.
And we will be right back. We are going to actually know here an interview I did in August with Rufina Juarez from the South Central Farm, and let's go hear that.
On May 14th, non-governmental organizations, indigenous activists, United Nations officials, and government representatives convened for the sixth session of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. The Permanent Forum is an advisory board to the Economic and Social Council of the UN, has a mandate to discuss indigenous issues related to economic and social development, culture, the environment, education, health, and human rights, and was created 6 years ago due to pressure from indigenous women to address the lack of indigenous perspectives and participation in existing UN bodies and mechanisms. Joining us tonight is Rufina Juarez, part of a delegation and one of the representatives appointed to speak on behalf at this session of the struggle of the South Central Farm and representative of La Red Chicana Indigena. Welcome, Rufina.
Thank you.
Let's quickly just sum up the what happened with South Central Farm for our listeners. It was now bare, it's a little over a year ago that it was destroyed.
Right. 14 years that we had the biggest urban farm in the United States. It was very diverse in terms of the plants. It started in 1992 in an industrial part of the South Central, extreme poverty, and as you know, very highly polluted. It was comprised of more than 350 families with individual plots that they cultivated and most of the people, 80% of the people, were of indigenous backgrounds. And communities including Mixtecos, Nahuatl, Maya, Seris, and Yagas. And the South Central Farmers, for the past three or four years, we have been battling with the greedy developer and our representative, Jan Perry, from the 9th District, to preserve the area because of the need of the people in the community.
And basically is forcibly taken from you.
Absolutely. And but we continue. There's a bigger goal for the South Central Farmers, and that is to continue to seek to end hunger and malnutrition, and to create a healthier form of diet based on respect and revival of our culture and traditional culture and customs. And we were invited by La Red Indígena Chicana, which was organized in 1997. It is a network of Chicana indígenas based in Arizona and California who are actively involved in the political, education, and cultural work that serves to raise indigenous consciousness among communities and supporters for justice and struggles of peoples of indigenous backgrounds in America from the north and the south. And what I was chosen to put on record at the UN, the excessive force that was used by the police on June 13th when we were forcefully removed in the middle of the litigation to the title of land when 350 indigenous families had been made dependent on the consumption, and also they were teaching their children how to farm. And we feel that because of this, we have been denied the right to grow our traditional food and teach our children the relationship to the land.
And also, you went to talk about the LAPD, the same LAPD that rioted on the poor people of Los Angeles on May 1st, 2007.
Correct. We highlighted that in terms of the violence that's being used against indigenous or displaced people here in the United States, along with what is happening to the mothers that are being forced to abandon their children because of these laws that are discriminatory and policies that are in place.
And what sort of discriminatory laws and policies?
It has been historical, but we would know a good example that happened to the young gentleman by the name of Guzman who was born here in the United States, and he was removed, and his family was real worried for him, and family didn't know where to find his son. There's this long process of people waiting. They don't know where their children are or their parents are at when the Border Patrol comes in and does raids. This is totally incorrect, and it's not within the legal rights of the people who have been detained or their families. And that's because of the practices that are done with the INS against the
people. Well, now that's the ICE raids.
Yes.
Now, you also submitted a written statement to the permanent forum that was recorded and analyzed by the members and included for policy recommendations to the appropriate UN agencies from the forum when it was ended. And these agencies have a mandate to address, prevent, and intervene in human rights abuses to all people. But this forum mandates them to give special attention to issues affecting indigenous people. So can you talk about some of the issues you did bring up and what you presented in your written statement?
We had four recommendations. One was that we urged the UN members to adopt the United Nations Declaration on Indigenous Peoples as approved by the Council of Human Rights without any changes. And some of the changes that we're seeing is that people want to remove the self-determination clause, which that's not going to fit well with all the work that has been done. We also asked that the Special Rapporteur on Migration and the Special Rapporteur on Indigenous People and Human Rights look into the abuse of Indigenous people's rights, those of children who are in diaspora in the United States and who are suffering from malnutrition, undernutrition, which in effect is growing at an alarming rate. And what you see is an increase of diabetes in our young children at the age of 8, asthma and cancer and other diseases. We ask that they pay close attention to what's going on. We also ask that some of the UN member agencies concentrate on some of the data collection, because there is no good data collection to come back and say these are the numbers that are not being heard in the different communities throughout the United States of people who are in diaspora. Those are some of the recommendations that we made, based on what happened at a real small level here in Los Angeles with the families that were forcefully and violently removed from the land by the local government, which is the city council, and under the direction of Jan Perry, who sided with in this case, which is the corporate, the developer.
And do you see, you know, based on all that you said, the connections between basically indigenous people throughout the world, that some of the same issues that you're going through here in Southern California are going on throughout the world?
The same issues that people in diaspora in the United States are facing are issues that you're seeing. One of the summations that was done from the Indigenous Peoples Forum was one of the key reasons why indigenous people are being disenfranchised from their land and territories is because of the existing discriminatory laws, policies, programs that do not recognize indigenous peoples or the ways of working in terms of holding land, tenure systems, and they give priorities and claims to that of the corporate or the mega projects, which is the state and the private corporations. And this is just one point. Other central roles are in terms of denying the decision-making process to indigenous people. That was also brought up in terms of the free, prior, and informed consent of indigenous people when they come into their land and take their traditional medicines without any prior consent.
Right, and they take their resources and claim it's theirs and corporatize it and sell it.
Absolutely.
And that has a huge effect on your livelihood.
And you could tie that to what happened with the South Central farmers, that there was no respect in terms of informing the community that they needed to remove the community. If you drive by right now, you will actually see an empty lot right now not being used. And for the sake of the developer and siding with the developer, they remove people in a hostile manner, creating trauma to our children, but yet nothing has been replaced. And the South Central farmers continue to provide good quality food for the community. We have land that's on loan. Every weekend we are at different farmers market bringing food that is naturally grown in a traditional way. We have a farmers market the first Sunday of every month there at 41st and Alameda. But yet we don't see those politicians doing something in terms of providing that quality food that's so important for our communities. And as a result of that, we have children who are falling into the obesity or being exposed to the high risk of diabetes.
Well, I was at the farm before It was demolished, and then I saw it after, and it's literally heartbreaking. That farm was gorgeous, and there was over 150 medicinal plants, and all the time, the times that I was there, there was never any aggressive behavior by the people who were there at the farm. There was never a need for any abuse that came from the police at that time. And also, I remember at the time, they had just been granted the money to make the deal with Ralph Horwitz, and he said, I don't care if they have the money or not, they're never getting this land.
Absolutely, but you're seeing that in a international, at a worldwide level, you're seeing that the mega projects are pushing, even if there is a plan, even if there is a five-year plan to be able to incorporate some of the traditional knowledge, it's being destroyed.
Now, we need to move into the recent convention that you're at in Canada. This is Indigenous women from 17 countries across North, Central, and South America. Tell us about this conference and how significant it was for Indigenous women.
It's a very empowering conference to be able to be in a big room setting with women who are doing work in their communities, in their neighborhoods, in terms of dealing with the same issues that we're seeing in South Central, malnutrition, access to good quality food, access to health care, access to education, but a traditional education in terms of teaching your children your language or how you plant a certain way.
And the true history.
Respecting everything that's, I'm sorry?
I'm sorry, sorry to interrupt you. The true history of the Southwest.
Correct.
Which is never taught. You have to really research it or take a Chicano studies course and hope you have a professor at that level, you know, not at the high school level, that will really teach you the true history.
It's true.
And why is that important, though? It's obvious why it's important, but it makes a big difference as far as understanding land rights and water rights and how the children don't know where their roots are.
But we have that right to educate our children in our community. To be able to tell the truth is important. To be able to teach your language and to be able to have that knowledge so you could transfer it. It's a right that we as Indigenous people.
And at this fifth conference, it was the panels were designed to consider the unique human rights and challenges. Can you talk about, were there any new ideas that came up from this, different than when your experience with the UN conference?
In the UN versus here, I think we saw more examples in terms of the methods that are being used. How do you reintroduce people in terms of working collectively and doing it for the cause, for the whole community, versus in some cases you have programs from the government which will pay you to participate. So if people don't get paid, they're not willing to do it for a better cause, you still deal with those issues. How do we reinstate that when you have husbands who have left their homeland to work because of the conditions that are going around in the world, and they leave their children and their mothers, and they become dependent in terms of receiving the money that's sent to them? How do you re-empower the community to continue to do work on their land and grow their food when you have this big competition and NAFTA in front of you? So these are some of the, we spoke about some of the examples and also some of the barriers to that.
It's been wonderful talking with you, Rufina Reyes. I'm so sorry we're out of time, but I'd like you to tell our listeners what they can do to help and also what websites they might go to learn more.
Yeah, we have our website, www.southcentralfarmers.com. Please send us an email. There are several phones that you could call us. People are invited to participate in working with us through the farmers market or coming and sitting in some of our meetings. This is an issue that's going to be something that all families will have to face. The issue of good quality food is something that we need to have control of, that we have to be in control in terms of what we put in our food and our mouth.
And as far as learning more about the history, the 500-year history of the Chicana movement, the Chicana people. Like, is there a website or a book you can recommend?
The website we have, La Vida Indígena Chicana, also has a website. There's a list of books that are available. I think you always have to question when they tell you something. You always have to do the research. You have to educate yourself. That's an empowering tool. I mean, there's various books that I could mention, but remember, where there's oppression, there's resistance, and we always have to resist.
And that was an interview I had in August of 07 with Rufino Juarez, and literally today things are even worse, and you can still go by 41st and Alameda, and the land is empty. There's a lot going on, and the farm will return, that I believe. And you can go to southcentralfarmers.com, and we'll have more websites on our page to keep up with what's going on.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Feminist Magazine here on KPFK, Los Angeles, 90.7 FM, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming and archived on the web at kpfk.org. We're your hosts, Christine Kings and
Melissa Chiprin.
We'll be right back after these KPFK announcements with Lindsay Horvath, the president of Hollywood Now, to discuss the nearly 7,000 rape kits that are sitting in the LAPD freezer shelves waiting testing.
Hello, I'm Don Bustani, host of Middle East in Focus. Spring fun drive's over. Thank you for your support. This week we have a new update on the UC Santa Barbara professor accused of anti-Semitism by the misbehaving ADL. We'll talk with the Jewish Australian journalist who asked in the Israeli media, why aren't Jews outraged by the Israeli occupation? And we'll talk with the Free Gaza movement as they get set to sail again to the Gaza shore with a load of humanitarian supplies. Middle East in Focus, tonight at 8 o'clock.
And we're back. Christine?
Yes, so we're going to be speaking shortly with Lindsay Horvath. She is the president of Hollywood Now. She's also the outgoing president of the National Women's Political Caucus, LA Westside, and she is currently on the board of directors of the Women's Reproductive Rights Assistant Project, or RAP, as it's known. She was recently appointed to the City Council of West Hollywood and is a producer for V-Day. So we're just waiting to get Lindsay on the line. It might be just a minute or so. But in the meantime, what we'll do is we'll go ahead and just kind of give you a little bit of a background on the LA City Council approval. They basically approved a budget to test rape kits. It was a response to City Controller Laura Chick's report on the LAPD's backlog of 7,000 untested rape kits, over 200 of which are already past the statute of limitations. And in a press conference back May 18th, which is when the City Council approved the measure, Chief William Bratton admitted that the issue was a tremendously important problem. And although Laura Chick calls for fixing the problem in 3 years like New York City did when it had a backlog of 17,000 kits, Bratton's plan will clear the backlog, or the backup, I should say, to zero by 2013. That is if the funding even comes in. And even though the program previously lost $500,000 in an internal clerical error, Bratton's two-prong plan basically will grow the number of criminalists and lab techs by over 30, as well as contracting to DNA labs across the country. So it's a very important issue, and we're really happy to be having Lindsay on the line soon.
So wait a minute. So when did the first – how far back to the 7,000 did you have that?
Well, that's one of the, you know, informations that Lindsay's going to be talking to us about. But I'm –
if we're in 2009 and it's going to take 4 years,
that's
a lot of rapists potential or, you know, alleged or are running around. What do women's lives matter? You know, when you hear these things, how could it's just outrageous to imagine that 7,000 rape kits could be sitting there for so long. And hopefully Lindsay will be here to explain this all to us. We're going to go to a music break and we will be right back. still trying to get a hold of Lindsay. If you're out there, Lindsay, call us at 818-985-5735. I'm going to update us on the hunger strike at LAUSD. It's, you know, they had the original hunger strike, and now it's been continuing. This is the second part. It's the third day of the hunger strike. This was a couple days ago at the LSUD. The hunger strike is for education. It's been in progress 24/7. It's in front of the LAUSD headquarters, and it's concerned with community members Judith Cuauhtemoc, Yolanda Centeno, and Guillermo Suarez. Community organizations, parents, students in Danza, Mexica, Cuauhtemoc have extended the hunger strike and compactment at LAUSD to prevent the further destruction of public education in Los Angeles by preventing dramatic preventing dramatic class size increases and teacher layoffs in the LAUSD. And we do have our guest on the phone. Welcome, Lindsay.
Hi.
Hey, Lindsay. We're glad you made it.
Yes, I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Yes, we're super excited. I already introduced you to our listeners, and congratulations on being appointed to the council. That's very exciting. So let's just jump right in. Let's talk about the issue. Let's see here. Why don't we go ahead and have you explain about the backlog and when actually it was discovered?
Well, I got on the case this past fall. Controller Chick, now Inspector General Laura Chick, put out a report about the finances regarding the testing of the backlog of untested rape kit evidence. And we came to find out that this was many years in the making, that her report was merely one step to try and help uncover the fiscal mismanagement aspect of what was keeping these kits from being tested and from perpetrators being brought to justice. And so with the Hollywood chapter of NOW and a coalition of various organizations in the community, when Laura brought this to our attention, we quickly got on the case, and we started writing to our representatives saying that this must be a priority. And so what we came to find out was at the start of it, there were reports. We had worked with Human Rights Watch as well, and they had done a comprehensive report which illuminated about 12,000 kits had gone untested, and that was both in Los Angeles City and in Los Angeles County. And so what we tried to do, we knew we had to take a two-pronged approach, which was first we had to speak with LAPD and then also speak with LASD to determine what was going to be the best plan of action with each department.
And how was the LAPD in terms of being responsive to you?
LAPD was actually very helpful, and I think for a myriad of reasons, not the least of which was this was something that had been going on for many years. Human Rights Watch had been working with Gail Abarbanel at the Rape Treatment Center in Santa Monica and council members Weiss, Garcetti, and Gruhl in repeatedly bringing this to council's attention that there was this constant back and forth between LAPD saying, we want to test the kits, we just don't have enough money, and council saying, we're giving you enough money, you just have to make this a priority. Mm-hmm. And so what we did was we approached LAPD saying, we just want to help. We understand that there's been a back and forth for many years, but now we just have to solve the problem. You know, we can't have this back and forth anymore, because at the end of the day, the people who suffer are the people who are survivors of sexual violence and who aren't seeing their perpetrators brought to justice. And so we did find them to be really receptive, and we worked with them to identify a plan that would eradicate this backlog in 18 to 24 months, and we found out how much it would cost. And then we went to the mayor and told him how much money he needed to allocate in the budget for the upcoming fiscal year. And he allocated enough money, and then it went on to the city council. It went to the budget and finance committee and then to the whole council, and we were then able to successfully get enough money in the budget. And one of the stipulations of getting the money was also to incorporate a plan of accountability to make sure that once we had the money given over to LAPD, that they would actually use it properly, because that was a concern of ours, because there had been instances of fiscal mismanagement. And so we wanted to make sure that if we're working this hard to get them this money, they need to use it in the right way, and they need to stay on schedule. So we've incorporated also a system of accountability, which we're really happy about.
And just if you can briefly describe the system of accountability.
Absolutely. In the past, the only form of accountability, this is a question that I've had of LAPD, well, how are you held accountable at this point? And they really said, other than giving verbal reports to the Public Safety Committee, they really didn't have ways of reporting what, if any, progress they were making on the backlog. And so now they will be giving full written reports that will be available to the entire council and also available online to the public. They will also include how money is spent, how many kits have been tested, and we are hoping to also find out what evidence, what conclusions have been drawn once they've tested this evidence, because we've already seen once they started testing some of the kits that the evidence has now brought perpetrators to justice on multiple crimes, and it's just by testing one kit. So we're seeing some success, and this is, you know, sort of, it was refreshing to have that happen very quickly, to say, look, this is why we're advocating so vehemently for you to test every single kit, because there's also a question now in the LA Sheriff's Department whether it's fiscally responsible to test every kit, because there's a feeling that because some kits are past the statute of limitations, or because for a myriad of reasons, that we shouldn't be testing every kit. And it's just unconscionable to ever say that a kit shouldn't be tested. You just can't say that.
And are there any ramifications? My gosh, so these people who haven't been brought to justice are out there raping more women.
Fair to the victim. It's like it wasn't their fault that the LAPD, wasn't on task,
Exactly, and that's what we've been saying, that, to ever say that a kit shouldn't be tested because it's not a wise use of resources is not only a PR nightmare, but it tells survivors of sexual violence that they shouldn't report, because why go through a four-hour process of collecting all of that evidence? Why go through the days and weeks and months and years-long process of waiting around to see what, if anything, will come of that evidence if you've already been violated in the worst and most horrific of ways? Why take that next step if it's not going to amount to anything?
And there's so many other messages that tell women don't report, you won't be believed. One third of people think women are lying. So there's compiled with all this, exacerbates everything as far as continuing to blame the victim.
Right. And another thing that we've been saying is, this isn't a women's issue. I mean, yes, as feminists, this is what we do, but it's not a women's issue. It's a public safety issue. To say that, we're asking for special privileges or special rights is just simply inaccurate. We're asking for our law enforcement officials to do their job, and we're asking for our elected officials to fund our local law enforcement to be able to do their job. This isn't a complicated question. It's really very simple. This is a public safety issue, and we have to provide public safety.
And do you feel, Laura Chick, what is her position now?
Now she's been appointed to the position of Inspector General for the state of California, where she's overseeing the stimulus funds that are coming into the state.
And obviously it was part of her job, her prior position, to look into this. So, how was she able to get all this information?
My understanding is she had been working, as I said, with Human Rights Watch and with Gail Abarbanel from the Rape Treatment Center, and they had for many years been talking about this issue. And so Controller Chick, being the fantastic feminist that she is, looked into the issue from the way that she was able to, which was financially. And so she was saying, every year we talk about this around the time of the budget, and every year we talk about how much money is being given to LAPD. How is LAPD really using their money? And so that's really what she did, and she went into, looking at the amount of money that was allocated to DNA testing in general, because throughout the country there's a backlog of DNA testing, and specifically there's an even worse backlog with rape kits throughout the country. It was worse in Los Angeles. And actually this problem was present in New York a few years back, and when it came to the attention of the local elected officials, they allocated funding in their budget and they eradicated their backlog in 3 years, and they had a smaller backlog than Los Angeles. So we said, you know, when we were first starting out, we said we want to see a plan, we want to see it happen in 3 years, and we want this to be taken care of. And now we successfully, with the city, have seen progress to identify a plan to which they've committed they'll be able to test every kit in 18 to 24 months and to have it fully funded by the city. We're very glad, because there was question as to whether people in the community could, you know, being part of Hollywood now, many people were saying, well, can we contribute? Can we make a donation? How can we help? And while that was very generous of the people who were willing to step up and offer that, again, we were saying this is a public safety issue. We shouldn't be relying on the charity of our citizens to, you know, make sure that rape kits are being tested.
Yeah. And will the victims or the owners of these rape kits, will they be notified?
Well, the system to date was not informing them of what was going on with their kits. And we had experienced many victims who had said that, you know, the kit was collected, and the kit is actually the evidence, and that the kit is sort of a misleading word. The rape kit is actually the evidence that's collected. So the evidence had been collected, and then they didn't hear what was going on. It was sort of difficult for the victims themselves to be able to follow up. What we were finding is that, you know, what information was actually recorded from these kits made it very difficult to track down how to relate them to people and what was actually contained in the kits. You know, we were asking how can we tell, for example, how many survivors, how many people had kits collected who were from the city of West Hollywood. And we were told, well, we don't track the kits that way. And to me, and probably to every layperson, you would think it would be easy to say, well, this is how many are from people in West Hollywood. But what the reality is it's where the crime is committed. So it could be a person from Beverly Hills in the city of Los Angeles, or it could be someone from the city of Los Angeles who goes to Culver City, which is covered by the LA Sheriff's Department. So it doesn't matter where you live, it matters where the crime occurred to the PD or to the Sheriff's Department. So that's sort of where the system that was in place really wasn't serving us to be able to get adequate and rapid response information out to people.
Lindsay, we are very happy that you were able to come on the air. We'd love to have you back in the future.
Thank you so much.
Again, I want to congratulate you on your appointment to the City Council of West Hollywood.
Thank you.
And please keep up the good work. Lindsay, can you please leave our listeners with some websites or some information or something that